So, in August 2026, Philadelphia police raided this house in the only neighborhood, and they're expecting, just a relatively standard bust.
Right, just your average police operation.
Exactly. But what they found instead was, well, it was a 44-year-old man named Eugene Horsch, and he was just sitting in what the media is now calling this, like, mystery house.
A mystery house.
Yeah, and he was surrounded by loaded guns, fraudulent FBI and DEA badges, and this is the key part, a hard drive.
And that hard drive changed everything.
Really did, because when investigators actually opened it, the contents were so unspeakably graphic that they immediately went to the public. They announced that two women who had been missing for years were likely dead.
It's just horrific.
It is. But to understand how this modern-day horror unfolded, we actually had to abandon the present completely. We have to rewind the clock to, like, a CIA front operation in the early 1960s. So welcome to today's deep dive.
Glad to be here.
We are on a mission today to trace this really chilling, multi-generational web of crime. And we're pulling from a stack of incredibly diverse sources for this. We've got a breaking news article from the Hindustan Times covering Eugene's 2026 arrest. And we're cross-referencing that with an archival audio transcript from an underground show called The Rialto Report.
Okay.
Okay, let's unpack this, because this case is essentially a set of Russian nesting dolls. Every doll you open just reveals something even darker.
That is a perfect way to describe it, because it is just this staggering juxtaposition. You have this real-time unfolding police investigation on one hand, right?
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, you have this decades-old audio confession from a man who gleefully, and I mean gleefully, describes himself as a banknote forger, drug smuggler, sociopath, and ex-convict.
And that man is Ray Vorsch, Eugene's father.
Exactly, Gene's father. And the online true crime communities, I mean, they are already in a frenzy over this. They're looking at the hard drives, they're looking at the missing women linked to Eugene's property, and they are stamping the label serial killer duo on this father and son.
Which is an incredibly heavy label to just throw around. I mean, the media in Philly is already drawing these direct comparisons to Gary Heidnik, the notorious 1980s serial killer who had the pit in his basement. Are we really looking at history repeating itself here?
Well, before we get completely swept up in the internet hysteria, we do need to look at the actual facts on the table. Eugene Horsch is currently facing federal weapons and fraud charges. He has not, and I want to stress this, he has not been formally charged with murder yet.
Right. Innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. We are just imparting what the sources are reporting, not acting as a jury.
Exactly. But the facts are that four missing women, Maribel Fresses, Gabrielle Amirondo, Blair Tonzelli, and Amy McHale, are now directly linked to his property.
I look at this list and I look at the fake federal badges and I just keep wondering, how does a person arrive at a point where they are stockpiling weapons and impersonating federal agents in a house tied to missing people?
To answer that, you really have to look at the architecture of his reality. You have to look at the man who built the world that Eugene grew up in.
His dad.
Right. And that takes us back to that Rialto Report transcript featuring Ray Horsch. Because Ray wasn't just some, petty criminal. In the early 1960s, at just 21 years old, Ray got a job with a security firm called Wackenhut.
And according to our sources, Wackenhut wasn't just like a bunch of mall cops. This was essentially a massive front for the CIA.
Precisely. They handled domestic intelligence gathering that government agencies couldn't legally do themselves. So Ray was brought in as this freelance operative.
At 21, that's crazy.
I know. He spent his early 20s literally bugging politicians' phones and breaking into the headquarters of the American Nazi Party to install wiretaps. I mean, he was trained to operate entirely in the shadows, entirely above the law.
But the sources also mention these completely absurd, almost comical crimes from this era, too. Like, at one point, he broke into an aircraft company in Maryland and stole 30 cabinets of top secret document.
30 cabinets.
Right. And then he supposedly stole a company airplane. And I gotta be honest, I'm struggling to understand the logistics of that. You don't just put a plane in your pocket and walk away.
Well, he didn't fly it out. He literally towed it across the airfield with a tractor.
Wait, what? A tractor.
In the middle of the night. Yeah,
Yeah.
he just towed it and hid it. And it's a perfect example of his methodology. Think about it. Security protocols are designed to look for airborne threats, right? Like someone
Right.
starting the engine, making a ton of noise, and taking off.
Right, they're looking up, essentially.
Exactly. Ray recognized that blind spot. He approached the theft as a ground-level logistics problem. He completely bypassed the complex security by doing the most mundane, unexpected thing possible.
That is wild. But okay, this is where I am completely confused by his psychological profile.
Yeah.
You have this guy who is stealing top secret documents, running black ops, living this adrenaline-fueled, high-risk James Bond life.
Yeah.
Yet when the draft for the Vietnam War comes up,
mm-hmm.
he completely balks.
He does.
And he doesn't claim like a moral or pacifist objection, right? According to the transcript, he tries to get legally classified as a, quote, devout coward. He actually goes to the recruiting sergeant and pretends to be wildly sexually attracted to him just to get disqualified.
Yes, he put on quite the performance.
So was he a criminal mastermind or just an extreme thrill seeker who refused to play by society's rules? Like, if he loves danger so much,
yeah.
why dodge the war in such a humiliating way?
Because it wasn't about the danger for Ray, it was about the authority. If you look at developmental psychology, some individuals develop an identity entirely predicated on oppositional defiance.
Okay, meaning what exactly?
Meaning Ray wasn't ideological, he just possessed this deep, venomous hatred for the very concept of civilization. He despised the idea that anyone, a general, a president, a teacher, could tell him what to do.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, he actually boasts in the interview about walking out of his third grade classroom every single day during morning prayers.
Just to rebel.
Exactly.
So he just wanted to be the contrarian, like the ultimate weird kid.
More than a contrarian. He wanted to be the villain. He explains that he grew up watching Saturday matinees and he would actively root for the bad guys. He found the hero, you know, the guy who saves the day and kisses his horse at the end.
Yeah.
He found that pathetic.
Wow.
He viewed the human community as fundamentally corrupt and stupid. And when you believe everyone else is stupid, the law stops being a moral boundary. It becomes nothing more than a technical challenge, a puzzle to solve.
Which perfectly explains his pivot in the 1970s, because he moves from being this rogue freelance spy to building literal underground empires. And he starts with counterfeiting.
Yes, he does.
He looks at cash and decides he wants to print his own $10 bills.
Yeah.
But, I mean, how does a guy in the 70s just bypass federal security measures? Even back then, they had ultraviolet scanners to detect fake money, didn't they?
They did. And what's fascinating here is how his obsession with technical challenges shines through. Standard commercial paper contains optical brighteners. There are chemicals that make the paper look crisp and white, but they glow vividly under a UV light.
Right, like when you wear a white t-shirt at the bowling alley and it glows purple.
Exactly like that.
Why?
But real treasury currency is printed on rag paper. It's made of cotton and linen, which absorbs UV light and stays dark. Ray realized he couldn't just draw a good visual fake. He had to defeat the chemistry.
Oh, wow.
So he went to extreme lengths to source specific unbrightened textile pulps that would mimic the exact physical properties of genuine bill under ultraviolet scrutiny.
That is terrifyingly brilliant. It's not a visual fake. It's a structural fake.
Precisely.
And he applied that exact same structural hacking to high art, too. The sources detail how he forged Picasso etchings so perfectly that they were authenticated and sold by Sotheby's and Christie's.
Yeah, that was a whole other level.
Because an etching isn't just a drawing. It's a physical impression pressed into paper from a carved copper plate. How on earth do you fake the physical weight of a Picasso?
By mastering the archaic process of intaglio printing, he had to reverse engineer the exact chemical composition of the acid Picasso used to bite into the copper. He had to replicate the depth of the grooves, the specific burr of the metal that holds the ink, and the exact pressure of the printing press so the paper would bear the correct tactile indentation.
That sounds like a lifetime of work just to make one fake.
It was incredibly tedious, but what he was really hacking was human psychology.
What do you mean by that?
He understood social engineering. He didn't sell these fakes in back alleys to tourists. He submitted them to the highest arbiters of authenticity in the world.
Sotheby's and Christie's.
Right. Once an expert at Christie's touches that paper, feels that indentation, and declares it real, their own professional reputation becomes a shield for Ray's forgery.
Oh, I see. Because if they admit it's a fake later.
Exactly. Once they validate it, they have zero financial or reputational interest in ever admitting they were fooled. He weaponized the art world's own arrogance against itself.
Man. But the Secret Service doesn't care about art world arrogance, and they eventually bust him for the fake money. He ends up doing 18 months in a federal prison in Florida.
Which didn't slow him down at all.
Not at all. In fact, it sounds more like a networking retreat because he spends his time smuggling liquor to his old CIA boss, H.L. Hunt, who happened to be locked up in the exact same facility.
You really can't make this stuff up.
You can. But prison clearly didn't rehabilitate him because the second he gets out, He abandons paper trails entirely and moves into consumables. He pivots to drugs.
And he approaches the drug trade with the same clinical structural mindset. He decides to manufacture amphetamines. Now, typical meth labs of that era were notorious. They utilized highly volatile chemicals like anhydrous ammonia or red phosphorus.
Yeah, they were super dangerous.
They reeked and they exploded constantly. It was a messy, dangerous, low-level game.
Ray doesn't do messy.
No. Ray teaches himself college-level organic chemistry. He engineered a sophisticated synthesis process that stabilized the volatile precursors. He essentially created a closed-loop system that scrubbed the toxic identifiable fumes and eliminated the risk of explosion.
So he's not blowing the roof off his house.
Right. He could operate massive laboratories right under the nose of law enforcement without giving off the telltale odors.
He was basically Walter White, decades before that was even a concept on television. And the scale of this was massive. By 1979, he claimed he was supplying over half of all the amphetamines circulating in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Maryland.
Half of the tri-state area.
Yeah. Plus, he's using the flying skills he picked up somewhere along the way to run marijuana over the border. Our sources describe him flying this specialized bush plane low over the desert, just dumping bales out the window, and flying home to attend Sunday dinners with Philly mobsters. Just casually walking out with paper grocery sacks stuffed with $250,000.
Yet, if you look at his motivations in the transcript, the money was secondary to him. And ironically, he didn't even use the drugs he sold.
Really? A drug kingpin who doesn't use?
Nope. He recounts a story of trying marijuana exactly once. He said he clumsily knocked over an antique vase while high and decided right then and there he would never alter his brain chemistry again. He considered his unclouded intellect to be his greatest source of amusement.
Okay, so if it wasn't about getting high, and it wasn't entirely about the money, what was driving this massive operation?
It was a game of chess against the federal government. He talks about being tracked by the DEA in a high-speed Apache aircraft.
Okay.
Because Ray was flying a rugged, incredibly slow bush plane, the DEA pilots couldn't match his low speed without stalling out, so they just kept flying right past him.
That is hilarious.
And he loved that. He loved outmaneuvering million-dollar government tech with a slow plane and a smirk. That is, until they finally cornered him with a helicopter and an M16.
Which kicks off his era as an international fugitive, because he flees to California, then goes totally off the grid to New Zealand. He even starts, like, a legitimate alcohol-fueled distillery there before his pass catches up and he has to run again without a passport. It's just a relentless cycle of reinvention with this guy.
It really is.
But as we pivot back to our mission today, which is understanding Eugene's 2026 arrest, we have to look at what Ray was doing alongside building these criminal empires. Because his arrogance didn't just manifest in crime, it bled into a horrifying desire to manipulate human psychology on film.
Yes. This is the critical juncture. This is the transition from outsmarting the law to actively degrading humanity.
Yeah.
In 1973, utilizing funding from his organized crime connections, Ray directed a film called The Erotic Memoirs of a Male Chauvinist Pig. And he boasts in the interview that it shattered every conceivable taboo.
The sources make it sound incredibly disturbing.
It was. We're talking about extreme bondage, simulated rape, and deeply disturbing power dynamics. It was a deliberate, calculated attempt to push the boundaries of what could legally and psychologically be shown on a screen.
And he didn't stop there. Decades later, in 2006, he shoots this experimental movie called Snuff. And this is where my blood runs completely cold, because Ray casts himself in the role of a serial killer actively torturing a victim.
Playing the villain, just like he always wanted?
Exactly. And in the archival transcript, he justifies this. He claims he was conducting a quote-unquote sociological exploration into why women desire to be in abusive relationships. He actually says these women view themselves as pieces of garbage, so they naturally seek out men who will treat them as such.
It is a breathtaking display of malignant narcissism. I mean, he is creating violent propaganda to justify his own lack of empathy. He is framing his sadism as some sort of elevated performance art or psychological truth.
It's disgusting. But I have to stop here, because this is the burning question for me, and I'm sure for everyone listening to this deep dive. While Ray is building meth labs, dodging the feds, and filming simulated torture, where is his son? Like, is Eugene sitting in the living room while his dad is directing these horrors?
This brings us to the absolute most devastating part of the archival material. Ray operated with this grandiose detachment from humanity, viewing everyone as props. But he did have a family.
Right.
The woman who held his life together during his years as an international fugitive eventually began to unravel. After Ray served his final stint in prison in the 80s and came home to work a quiet IT job, his wife's mental health completely collapsed.
Oh, no.
She died by suicide, taking a lethal overdose of prescription pills. And Eugene, who was just 7 years old at the time, was in the room when it happened.
A seven-year-old boy.
Yeah.
Watching that happen.
Yes. And I want you to consider the developmental psychology of a child in that environment. A child's brain forms its fundamental concept of morality and empathy by mirroring its primary caregivers.
Okay, so they learn how to feel based on what they see.
Empathy isn't just innate. It is modeled. So what happens to a child's internal compass when the person modeling reality for them is a father who explicitly teaches that laws are a joke? A father who creates films depicting the torture of women and calls it art? A father who refers to victims as garbage?
It's completely warped.
When a caregiver actively shatters the boundary between extreme violent fantasy and everyday reality, the child's mirror neurons wire themselves to associate violence with normalcy.
It's like growing up in the Truman Show, but the director's a sociopath. You inherit a completely broken version of reality.
Exactly. The trauma isn't just an emotional wound in this case. It is an environmental conditioning. Eugene's baseline for normal human interaction was built on a foundation of deception, contempt, and simulated murder.
Which violently snaps us back to the present day. Here's where it gets really interesting. We are back at the Chew Avenue house in August 2026. The simulation that Ray created on film appears to have mutated into something horribly tangibly real in Eugene's life.
The line between performance and reality finally dissolves.
It does. Because investigators didn't just find hard drives with graphic videos. They found physical, handwritten documents in Eugene's home. These writings were explicitly focused on the notorious serial killer, Ted Bundy.
Which is chilling in itself.
Very. And the details are so specific. The notes reference zip ties, a drum, detailed plans for killings, and a phrase that investigators highlighted, quote, trash that needs to go.
Trash that needs to go. It is almost a verbatim echo of his father's philosophical justification for the snuff film.
Oh, man, you're right.
The father claimed victims were garbage who wanted to be used, and now the son writes about trash that needs to go. The through line is just undeniable.
And the connections just get darker.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned earlier that four missing women are linked to Eugene's property, right?
Mm.
We have Maribel Fresses and Gabriella Morando. We have Blair Tonzelli. And then we have Amy McHale, who vanished without a trace back in 2016.
Right.
According to the Hindustan Times, Amy McHale was married to Ray Horsch.
Yes.
She was Eugene's stepmother. Ray died in 2025, just a year before this police raid, and now his missing wife is directly tied to the horrific digital evidence found in his son's possession.
Now, as an analytical check here, we must remain grounded in the legal facts.
Mm-hmm.
The internet is screaming that they are a multi-generational killing team. But as of this report, Eugene has only been indicted on the weapons charges and the fraudulent FBI and DEA badges.
Right. We have to be clear about that.
The police are operating on heavy suspicions regarding the missing women based on the video evidence, but there are no murder convictions yet. We have to let the forensic process play out. Again, we are just looking at the evidence that's currently publicly available.
Absolutely. We aren't here to play jury. We are here to analyze the mechanics of behavior.
Yeah.
And you cannot look at those fake FBI badges and not see the ghost of Ray Horsch.
The psychological mirroring is undeniable. Ray spent his entire life obsessed with authority, deception, and outsmarting the system. He wore a CIA cover. He wore the guise of a legitimate artist. He played a killer on screen. And now, Eugene is arrested carrying fake federal badges, stockpiling weapons, and holding digital records that have police actively searching for bodies. Eugene seemingly inherited his father's playbook of subversion, but he stripped away the theatrical safety net.
That's a great way to put it.
Where the father stopped at the edge of the camera frame, the son seemingly walked right off the edge into the abyss.
So, as you're listening to this, you might be asking, why does this bizarre 60-year saga matter to me? We started with a breaking news alert about a police raid in Philadelphia, and we ended up dissecting the chemistry of meth labs, the mechanics of forged Picassos, and the psychology of 1970s underground films.
It's a lot of ground to cover.
It is, but it matters because this case is a masterclass in the true mechanics of generational trauma. We often think of inheritance as just genetics, right?
Yeah.
Or wealth. But this story shows how you can inherit a completely fractured reality.
Has.
If a child is taught mechanically and persistently, that empathy is a weakness, and that human beings are just pieces on a chessboard to be manipulated, the resulting collapse of their moral architecture is catastrophic.
It is a dark and profound legacy. And I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over as we conclude. Throughout his entire life, Ray Horsch justified his crimes, the fraud, the narcotics, the transgressive films, by claiming he was simply holding a mirror up to a society that was inherently violent and corrupt.
Yeah, he always had an excuse.
He claimed he was just exposing the monsters. But by systematically dismantling every moral boundary in his own life, and by raising a traumatized son in a shadow world of fake snuff films, fugitive paranoia, and a deep contempt for human life, did Ray actively engineer and build the exact type of real-world monster he claimed he was merely reflecting?
It is a haunting question. When you finally map out the anatomy of a crime scene like the one on Chew Avenue, and you trace the roots back through decades of deliberate, cultivated cruelty, you have to ask yourself, where does the responsibility of the father end and the nightmare of the son begin? Something to think about. Until next time.